No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from Washington, D.C., the America's last colony. Together with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and join the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR, and we'd love to hear from you. So let's start the show. Good evening. Maria, are you there?
I am. Back on the West Coast, Michael.
I know. And, you know, that's great. Maria Sanchez, you're a real trooper. You came all the way to Washington, D.C. to partake in our event on Friday night, and we so appreciate having you there. It was great to see you, and it was great to have you participate. And I think the event went pretty well. What do you think?
First of all, it was my privilege and an honor to attend and to see you and Mrs. Brown again and Karen and to meet Rachel and her fiance and Taboo and also to meet Christian Gregory in person and his lady, Melissa, and also the sister. How do you say her name?
Ayana.
And listen to her sing. And I mean, I could go on and on and on. And then there's, of course, the performance of Turn Me Loose, which I was able to see twice on Thursday night and Friday night. And I still can't believe that Edwin, the actor, can speak for 2 hours nonstop, going in and out of the various nuances of the character of Dick Gregory. It was staggering to me.
Well, he really great play. I think it moved a lot of people, especially the people that came to our event, because many of them were social activists, and many of them were friends of Dick Gregory's. I mean, it was nice that the actors came to our reception. They got to meet a lot of Gregory's family and friends, which I think was good for them. That made them feel good, and they got a big round of applause from people that knew this man because they did such a good job in portraying him. What an amazing life he had, huh?
Tremendous. And they, of course, 2 hours is actually too long, and yet it didn't even get to all the things that he did, which, of course, how could you? He did it. I was thinking he was integrating movie theaters as a student in 1953, and he lived until 2017. That's how long he was at it, and who knows what he did before 1963. But nevertheless, I mean, with 60-some years of and sacrificing his life and his health and, you know, who knows, putting whom else in harm's way just by him physically being in attendance or near somebody. And I mean, just to think about this man who, it's only been a year since he passed away in August of 2017, gives me the shivers that he was walking the walk in my lifetime. And you, Michael, had the opportunity and the privilege to actually interact with him on an individual basis.
Yes, and he was an amazing, amazing man. And yeah, he ran for mayor of Chicago. He ran for president of the United States. He, I listened to and actually participated in a show that he was in, that his son, Christian Gregory, was on the other day, the Kojanandi Show, which is a big talk show in Washington on NPR. And the host asked the question, is there anybody out there today that's doing the kind of racially charged, cutting edge humor that he did? And I think the answer to that question is yes, there are. There are several comics, but there's none that are doing it the way he did it, which is that, you know, we have this old saying in politics that you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk. And that was him. He walked the walk. He didn't just stand up and do stand-up comedy. He did it as a means to a larger goal, which was to pursue issues of social justice. So he got arrested in front of the South African embassy. He got arrested on Capitol Hill for statehood. And it's funny, while we were selling tickets to this event, and just to explain briefly, the event was to honor him on his what would have been his 86th birthday, but also to combine it with an issue that he cared about and that I care about, statehood. But while I was calling people trying to sell tickets, trying to get them to the event, so many of them had stories about how they had been arrested with Dick Gregory. Many of the people at the reception the other night had actually been arrested and gone to jail with him over several different issues. So this was a guy that used his talent for a broader goal, and that was to seek social justice. And his daughter, his lovely, lovely daughter, Ayanna Gregory, still does that. You heard her sing briefly. We'll have to play some of her music on the show. She really has an amazing voice.
Absolutely spectacular.
But she does a lot. I know her because she comes to social justice things. She comes to things for statehood. She comes to things for other causes. So she's following in her footsteps, her father's footsteps, and so is his son, Dr. Christian Gregory, who runs his foundation. There was such an outpouring of love for this man. It's amazing. And I think a whole new generation is starting to discover him. You know, people that didn't know him. There's a book being written, Dr.
And
Schiff.
Didn't get to meet him.
Didn't?
No.
He was so, you know what? He introduced himself to me, or I wouldn't have known he was there, because he was very quiet, and he sat kind of stayed to himself a little bit because he didn't know a lot of the people in the room. But yeah, I got to talk to him for a minute. And he's writing a book. There's also a film that's being done that's going to be released soon. We saw a documentary on him. So there's a lot of projects going on. Christian Gregory is like all over the place working on these things. So it really is amazing. It's like a whole new generation out there that's finally discovering him because he lived to be 84 years old. So a lot of younger people don't know who he was or what he did, but he just did amazing things, and he was an amazing guy. And what courage, huh? There's a scene in the play where he refuses to go on Jack Parr, the Tonight Show, because he thinks that black comics aren't treated well on the show. He tells Parr that thanks, but no thanks, because he wants to sit on the couch. And they're never invited to sit on the couch. And, you know, that took such great courage for a guy.
Absolutely.
Right? Because the Tonight Show, that was the holy grail.
The vehicle, right.
Yeah, and it was the holy grail for comics.
What I found in my research was that the Jack Parr Show called more than once.
Yeah.
And he declined without a caveat, or, you know, without giving a reason. And then Jack Parr himself called and said, I'm just really curious why you would keep denying a booking on my program. And he said, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. You don't let comics of color come and sit on your couch after they do their show. I'm not going to participate unless I'm a part of that process. And he said, all right, you can sit on the couch. But back in the day, Johnny Carson, that was true with him, regardless of the skin color. When you were a comic and you were booked on a show, especially if you were a young unknown, you weren't guaranteed couch time unless Johnny Carson liked you. And then he would give the infamous wave over. And then you knew you really had made it, because now you're sitting on the couch talking to Johnny. So apparently, since Jack Parr was Johnny Carson's predecessor, this is something that was part of the process about the host beckoning you over. But in Jack Parr's instance, I do believe it was racially motivated, whereas at Johnny Carson's, it was, did you tickle his fancy or not?
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. You know, it was a different age. And
right.
So few of us remember Jack Parr. I mean, I was, I barely remember him.
I only know his name, and it's only because of infamy.
Yeah, and I remember vaguely seeing him as a child, but Johnny Carson was the man to me. You know, he was the Tonight Show, always will be the Tonight Show, even though, you know, I was lucky enough to get to know Jay Leno a little bit. I actually was with Jay Leno the night that Carson's son was killed in an accident. I was invited to meet him. I went backstage, and he was the most gracious guy. I've just seen his stand up, which you could take your grandmother to. I mean, it was so funny. So funny, but didn't use a foul word. And we went backstage, and we're spending just sitting in his dressing room with him. When all of a sudden he stood up and he said, "I have to go." Johnny Carson's son was just killed in a car accident. And this was in the days when Leno was filling in for Carson, and they kind of knew he would take over, but he hadn't taken over yet. I had a friend that wrote jokes for Carson who invited me, I'm sorry, for Leno, who invited me to come meet him. And so
one of my buddies was his monologue writer for 20 years or something. 15 years. I've met Jay Leno on numerous occasions, and you're exactly right. He acts like he's an everyday guy, you know, with his jeans and his blue jeans and his blue denim top, basically uniform, like Steve Jobs with his black jeans and his black top, you know, these iconoclastic men and their cookie cutter wardrobes. I wonder if there's something to it in that regard. But Jay has lent his name to many causes. I actually had the opportunity to interview his wife, Mavis, because she's been doing amazing work for disadvantaged women throughout the world. And quietly.
When I met him, some woman had written him a letter in Virginia. This was at Wolf Trap, was the venue in Virginia. And she wrote him a letter saying that she was a fan, and she had tried to see him several times, but he was always sold out, and she was so disappointed. And, you know, she would love to get tickets to a show. So he brought her whole family. He brought her whole family, like 8 people, and they all came backstage, and they spent time with him, and they were thrilled to be there. And he took his picture. I have a picture on my office wall of the two of us, because he took pictures with everybody, you know, and he was just a really warm guy. But
To that point, you can speak to this, which I cannot, except through my research. Dick Gregory was that way with everybody, making time for anybody, making them feel like they were the only person in the room.
Yes. Well, you know, I was going to say, and I didn't get a chance to say it on Friday night, but my favorite quote from the Old Testament is Micah, which is, "What does God ask of you but to seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God?" And this very much to me embodies, the reason I was going to say it is it embodies who Dick Gregory was. He always sought justice. His son, Kristen, who was on the show last week, told me that he had a trunk full of signs, depending on what event, you know, whether he was standing in front of
what they were picketing for.
Yes, whether he was standing in front of the South African embassy picketing against apartheid, or whether he was going on Capitol Hill protest the lack of rights for voting rights for the District of Columbia, whatever he was going to do. He also, I think, loved kindness because he was a very kind person. And I think people that are kind a really cherished kindness and really appreciated in others. And he was humble. The first time I met him, you know, it's funny that our paths crossed many times because he came and he spoke at my little white college outside of Washington, D.C. when I was a college student more than 40 years ago. And he slayed us. I mean, we laughed until we cried and he left us thinking. And then 20 years later, I went to a ceremony, a small graduation ceremony at the School of Nutrition at the University of Maryland, where I had a friend, and he was the commencement speaker in a room full of about 200 people. And so we ran into each other again. And, you know, he just when I met him, I followed his career and he was an icon to me, but he acted like we had known each other our whole lives. He acted like, you know, he was just another guy and gee, it was nice to see me again. He really was a wonderful and warm person.
So interesting, too, to that end, there were nuances in the play that were subtle that spoke about where he was in his life, because at one point he was an overweight man who drank daily and smoked cigarettes.
Yeah.
And they referenced that, I think he said a quart of scotch, sometimes two a day, and four pack of cigarettes. Yeah. And so when the actor Dick was portraying Dick Gregory in his early stand-up days, he had a glass of scotch or whiskey in, you know, his hand and an unlit cigarette, affecting that he was smoking it. And then he subsequently became, through nonviolence, he said, if I'm nonviolent with people, I should be that way with animals. So he gave up all flesh, including dairy and eggs and smoking, and lost weight, and then became a proponent of a healthy lifestyle and the promoter and creator of the Bahamian diet and lifestyle. And that was part of his activism as well. Not to mention the hunger strikes, which, you put your body in, it's not a fast, as Christian distinguished last week. When you are on a hunger strike, you're putting your body in peril.
Yes.
You're eating your organs if you fast and starve yourself long enough. And his attorney referenced on Thursday night at the Q&A that there was one time or more that he went on a fast where he didn't even consume water.
Yeah. Yeah, and she was there. If you're talking about Ife Williams, she
yes,
was there
I am.
Friday night.
Yes, because she's so advocate of statehood. So she was, she actually was his counselor. Legal counsel, and wrote up, she said, I know about this because I wrote those documents, or I know about that because I advised him on that. And I was thinking, how great is that, that she's still around and can speak of it and has seen the play, I think, over 10 times.
And she's the national director of the National Congress of Black Women. So she's quite an accomplished lady. We were
and ahead of her time.
We were honored to have her there. And there were several people like that. Dr. Frank Smith was there as well, and he is a former member of the city council and is the director and the guy who founded and created the African American Civil War Museum. And the next time you're in Washington, we're going to have to take you there because it's just an amazing, amazing place, you know, and African American participation in the Civil War had almost been forgotten. Historians had talked about it for years, but it had never been memorialized. And so Dr. Smith, actually, when he retired from the city council here in Washington, put together the museum. And it's just an amazing little museum that tells a story about how African Americans fought valiantly in the Civil War on the side of the North, to bring about their own emancipation, and they were inspired by a Washingtonian, Frederick Douglass, who said, you know, if we're gonna be liberated, we need to be part of the liberation. So it's very appropriate to have it here in Washington.
What a great statement.
We're in a fight right now over Frederick Douglass, because he was actually from Maryland. He was born in Maryland, but he lived much of his life in Washington, D.C. And we'll have to do a show on him one time, because he was a fascinating man. He was a businessman and like a local sheriff, and he was the advisor to President. Trusted advisor to President Lincoln, and you know, he really had an interesting, fascinating life. But his 200th birthday, I think, was this year, and you know, and there was a fight over was he a Washingtonian, was he from Maryland? You know, we always want to claim people that are accomplices, our favorite son. We have the same problem with Duke Ellington. We have the Duke Ellington School of the Arts here, because Duke lived here and performed on 8th Street, which they call the Black Broadway in Washington. But he's also, I think, originally from somewhere else, maybe New Jersey, I think, and they claim him as well. So,
the same is true of Picasso, because he was from Spain. And then he produced many of his works and his career in Paris. But when he passed away, the mural that he created for the demise of Franco, he said, I wanted to go to Spain, but not while Franco's still alive. And sure enough, once Franco was gone, it got liberated back to Spain. So they have that constant fight.
now you made me think of the story, and I have to tell you that when I first started my business, I started a business like 35 years ago. I had a consulting business for 25 years. And when I first started, I didn't have many clients. And so I thought it was, it didn't make me look good to always be available. Whenever anybody called on the phone, there I was, Johnny on the spot, because I just didn't have very many clients. So I used to take a long walk every day for like an hour or two in the middle of the day. So I wasn't always available, and it kind of got my energy up and gave me time to think. And I was walking by the Smithsonian one day.
Smithsonian? I learned on Friday there's 16 of them.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
They're not all in Washington either. Some of them, there's a couple in New York. But I was walking by what we call the West Wing, I think. It's the Gallery of Art.
Okay.
There's several galleries of art. So it's distinguished by being the westernmost building. And I'm walking by, and somebody comes up to me and says, hey, would you like to see, we're about to open an exhibit on Picasso, and it opens today, and we're giving out free tickets for, you need a ticket to get in, but would you like a ticket to come in? And I said, okay. And I went in, and I was standing there looking at a painting, like with a woman with three heads on one side of her body or something, trying to figure out what the hell it was. And I said, and this young, very attractive woman walked, and I was very young in those days, walked up next to me, and she said something like, it's very interesting, isn't it? And I said, yes, it is. And she explained the painting to me, and she said, and I said, well, you know a lot about this guy. And she looked at me and she said, yeah, he was my father. And I said, is your father? And she said, yeah, I'm Paloma Picasso.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm here for the opening, you know, and she shook my hand, and I was just stunned. I said, well, he did a really great job.
Well, I'm surprised you were so gracious, because so many people, he kept breaking traditions. And it took people, he was always ahead of the curve. So I've been a fan of Picasso my whole life. A lot has to do with him being a Spaniard. And Picasso is not his dad's name, it's his mother's name. He took her surname. And so I've read three biographies on him. I've been to the Picasso Museum, actually, in Paris. And then I've just finished, there's a National Geographic 8-part documentary that Ron Howard and Brian Grazer are behind it. It's called Picasso, Genius, and it stars Antonio Banderas as Picasso as an adult, and then there's a young Picasso, and they keep going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it's absolutely riveting and revolting because of his philandering and having children with multiple women. And, you know, I mean, it's like, oh my gosh. But he was always looking for inspiration and a muse and, you know, somebody that could keep him going. And he found it all the way till he died.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I saw some of his early work, and I just don't understand a lot about art. Just to be honest with you, I've never studied or anything. I have a nice art collection, and that was left to me, and I've got some beautiful pieces, but I like what I like, you know.
That's what art is.
Yeah, and I believe that. And I love Van Gogh because Van Gogh speaks to me. You know, I see it, and I see what he was, you know, what he was trying to say. And his work really speaks to me. But when I went to the Picasso exhibit, I saw some of his very early stuff, which was very traditional, and I thought it was beautiful. And then I saw some of his later works, and I just didn't get it.
Surrealism and cubism, you know, he was at the forefront of that. And,
right.
And he defied convention, and it took strength because the dollar was in conventional work. But he had a coterie of artists who said never, you know, bow down to the bourgeois lifestyle, always, you know, maintain your artistic integrity. And he was like, yeah, but sometimes he even did a ballet that had cubist characters over the ballerinas that they laughed at when it debuted. And then it took off, but it was touch and go there for a moment. And then Spain brought it in, and the Count brought it in, and he said, look at it, it's a Spanish artist, how bad can it be? And everybody was quiet because they didn't know what the Count was going to think. And then the curtain drops and there's this big silence. This is from the documentary. And then he decides to clap and stand up, and then everybody else does, and it becomes a huge hit in Spain.
Well, you know, I mean, I think, again, just to bring it full circle, that was the thing with Dick Gregory, too,
yes.
You know, that he said, you know, I have to be true to what I believe. And yes, going on the Tonight Show would be a great, and I'm sure there were many other instances in his life, but they just used this as part of the play, you know, would have been a big break for him. And he says that in the play, you know, he calls himself stupid and, you know, how could I do this? And, you know, I'm shooting myself in the foot. But he says, I got to be true to what I believe. And that's so hard. And it's so there's so few people that really, when push comes to shove, can do that. And, you know, but,
it takes true courage.
Yes, and I believe
true courage and integrity and character and morals and bravery, because his life was on the line for what he believed in. And I don't know about you, but some of his talks that he gave, either in his stand-up or in his interviews, this is during the play, I found it uncomfortable to listen to. And it was said 50 years ago or 40 years ago where he would scold people and call them on their bullshit, basically. And I thought, my goodness, that must have been really scary, because it could have gone either way. But he didn't care. He wanted the truth. And that was his truth. And he was going to speak his truth, whether it was socially comfortable or not.
Well, and we face this in politics all the time. I'll tell you, it's really, really hard as a politician. I'll be out there on election day, and someone will come and shake my hand, and they'll say something to me like, where do you stand on right to life? And I know that as soon as I say I stand for a woman's right to choose, there's a vote I'll never get. And it's hard to say it. But you've got to say it, right? It's what you believe in. And that's just a small example of that. Or to sit in front of a crowd that you know loves the person that you're opposed to, if it's mm-hmm. the mayor or somebody else, and say, look, they, you know, it's not that I don't like this person, but they're wrong. They're wrong. You know, I've been booed. I've had people say, I've had my children cry, call me on the phone crying because of the racially motivated things that have been said about me in the Washington Post when I ran against African-Americans, or at one time I was accused of hiding behind an African-American because you know, we had the same name, and people, I still get it. A Washington Post article ran a few months ago that still accused me of getting votes from black voters because they think I'm a black candidate, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, I've been in office for more than 12 years. But yeah, I remember an incident where the Washington Post wrote an article on that subject with my teenage daughter, who was at a slumber party with her hip hop group, where she was maybe the only white kid in the room, called me and said, how can they say this about you, Daddy? How can they say this about you? You know, and that's the thing about politics, that sometimes, you know, this is something that I accept, and all the politicians, I think, accept. But it's very hard for the people around you that care about you, because they don't sign on to see you be ridiculed and have harsh things said about you. But, you know,
speaking of the harsh things, I'm curious, because I've you know, in the debates, let's say, not presidential, I'm speaking local. Sometimes people can take the high road, and sometimes people sling the mud. And a member of our local assembly wanted to run for Congress, and the opponent was known for hitting below the knees. So his campaign asked me to come in and to role play as her and to do a mock debate so that I could prepare him for hearing things that were unspeakable. And I was role playing, right? I was being the actor, but I felt filthy saying the things that they told me to say. And I can't imagine what it feels like to be the recipient of that kind of vitriolic, disgusting speech. But sometimes it works. And guess what? His opponent won.
Yeah, it's unfortunately it does work. And, you know, again, I think it's harder for the people that care about you, because when it's you, you understand what's going on and you understand who you are, right? So when people call me, you know, in that instance, when they called me a racist, I know that I'm not a racist.
Right.
I mean, I've worked with black people all my life. I have black friends, Native Americans.
Hispanics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a racist bone in my whole body.
Right.
So it doesn't bother me on a personal level, you know, because I know it's trash talk, but it bothers those around you. As you can imagine, you know, if you were in a, you know, as a man, if you were somewhere and someone insulted your wife or your girlfriend, you know, that would be very hard to take. And that's what it's like. But yeah, it's unfortunate that it's like that. And, you know, we talk about how horrible it's gotten in politics today, but it's always been a part of politics. You know, that Andrew Jackson, his wife was just trashed in the press constantly. And just as he got elected and they were about to move into the White House, she died of a heart attack. And he always blamed the press. He said they badgered her to death. They badgered her to death because she was married in an arranged marriage to a cousin for one day. And the marriage was never consummated. But they used to refer to her as an adulteress because she married Jackson. And in fact, to get even, I always thought this was great, to get even, he had kind of a bawdy niece who was a barmaid in Washington, and he used to take her to every official function with him. And it just drove women like Dolly Madison, who were very, very proper, it just drove them up the walls that this woman would come popping out of her skirt and you know, her dress and he did it purposefully to annoy them. But it's been a part of policy. I'm sure people said, I'm sure there was some environmental candidate railing against George Washington for chopping down a cherry tree. So it's always been there.
Well, and they showed a nice segment about how terrible the racism was that Dick Gregory endured doing his stand-up and the hecklers making their horrific statements to him those were some of the scenes that I was just like, oh, I can't stand it. And that was 50 years ago that exchange happened at the Playboy Club.
You know, and the thing is that I think it was very, you know, again, subtle, but there that the guy that was doing it in the play is a teacher. He's a teacher from the South somewhere, Alabama or Mississippi, I can't remember, but he's a teacher. So they're saying, look, these were real people. They weren't just some dumb old redneck who had a third grade education. You know, they were educated, sophisticated in many ways. And
they traveled. They were in Chicago. Yeah. For a convention. So it wasn't like they were stuck, you know, which would suggest that they were white collar and upwardly mobile.
Yeah.
But to your point, still prejudiced and still racist.
Yes. And, you know, I think that, you know, when Dick Gregory says, you know, that he had to come in contact with his lifestyle and what he was doing, and when he got over it, it liberated him. And you know, with the meat and the sugar and the, you know, which he refers to as something like commercial
the cocaine of the food system,
food industry, right? And you know, and all this stuff, and it liberated him, and it made him a better person. As a social activist and on other levels, it wasn't just a physical health thing. Well, that's the thing about racism too. I think you have to understand you before you can actually liberate yourself. You have to understand how much impact the system and your upbringing has had on you and how it's affected you. And no matter how egalitarian you think you are or you try to be, you have to understand the role that racism plays in your life and sexism plays in your life. And I think that once you say, yeah, I'm may not be intentionally racist, but I certainly do have some racist tendencies because I was raised in a racist society, or I am misogynistic to a certain extent. I have to actively try not to be a misogynist because I was brought up in a misogynistic society. So I think you really have to address those things too before you can be truly liberated and truly egalitarian. And I know I did.
Well, along those lines, my family used all of those pejorative words to describe people of other, not races, but ethnicities. And I mean, they're so heinous to me now, I would never even repeat them, but they're akin to the N-word. And so Italians were this, and Polish people were that, and Irish were this. And there was a euphemism that was used instead of saying that. And I was raised in a family of immigrants. So when I look back, I think, wow. But my mother shares this. She says she was getting her training in Yonkers, New York, and she was a Spaniard from New Mexico with a Spanish land grant. And so someone asked her, what are you? And she said, I'm Spanish. And they said, oh, you're a SPIC. And she said, okay. So she didn't know that it was pejorative. So then she started introducing herself as a SPIC. And I think that may be why she had the innocence to use those other terms for other kinds of nationalities. But even when I was growing up, I found it heinous, offensive, and not funny. And I would look around at my family who thought, you know, how many blondes does it take to change a light bulb, but they would use another nationality in that joke. And I just thought, this isn't funny. This is putting people down. This is making gross generalizations. And now when I look back, I think, was I a nerd or was I ahead of my time?
Well, you know, I got very, very lucky because I grew up in a family where all those terms were used. My mother's family, you know, my grandmother, it was almost like she had been discriminated against when she came to this country. She was an immigrant from Italy, and now it was her turn, you know. And it was reinforced by ignorance. You know, my grandmother didn't associate with black people. She didn't associate with Latinos. She didn't, you know, so she never knew any difference, you know. But, yes, she used all those terms. And then I had my dad, who didn't particularly like people, you know, thought a lot of people weren't worth the time. But he truly believed in his heart that good people and bad people were evenly distributed among every race, ethnic group, religious group, sex. He really thought that people were people. So he was maybe the most liberated person I've ever met in my whole life in terms of those things. So I got to see both sides, you know, and it was amazing to me. I used to say to my mom, who believed all those stereotypes, she worked in a all-black school, and the children loved her. They worshipped her. And I would say to her, Mom, what do you think happens when they become adults? You know? But she would She would see the children as children, but she was afraid and fearful of adult black people and didn't want to, you know, live next door or have them in the neighborhood or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But she adored the children. In fact, there's a famous incident in our family where she was always the secretary to the principal in an all-black high school or predominantly black high school. And a kid stabbed his teacher on the way to the office. The teacher was bringing him to the office for disciplinary action, and he pulled out a knife and stabbed the guy in the stomach. Gym teacher. And as everybody ran, my mother stood up from her desk and walked down to the hall and looked at the kid and said, "What are you doing?" She said, "Give me that knife." And the kid put the bloody knife in her hand. And she said, "Now you go and sit in the office. You're in a lot of trouble, young man. You can't stab teachers." And the kid walked and sat in her office because she talked to him like a mom would talk to him. And he responded like a child because he was a child. And it was actually a middle school, not a high school. And then we had to beg her to testify against the kid. She said, "Oh, he comes from a broken home and blah, blah, blah." And we said, "Ma, he stabbed his teacher. He didn't steal milk money. He didn't cheat on a test. He stabbed it. You know, where do you draw the line?"
And interesting.
Luckily the case was pleaded, plea bargain, so she never had to testify. But you know, she adored the kids, but still she and that's the insidious thing about racism and sexism, isn't it? Is that a lot of times people that are perpetrators of it don't even understand that they are. You know,
that's a really good point. Insidious, is it? And it seeps through, though, with the type of language that you use or your behavior. You don't have to admit to being racist, but you can show that you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and all you have to do is you support racist policies or you act a different way towards people. And it's amazing. And, you know, one thing that people also don't understand about racism, and something that I've learned about being in politics in a city when I started in politics that was majority African-American. Now they're still the largest group, but they're not a majority anymore in Washington, D.C. But it's a two-way street. it's a two-way street. I've certainly walked into venues where people didn't like me because I was white. They didn't know anything more about me than that. So that's another thing that you have to realize about it, is that if you can be a woman and be a misogynist, you can be black and be racist. It's something that we all have to stand up to and face and deal with, I think. And I think we're doing that more and more and more in America.
But, well, you know, there's the term that's also outdated or not applicable, is reverse racism. And my sons were one to say that there's nothing reverse about it. It's either racist or it isn't. And right. I had, when I was a sophomore in college, I was a resident advisor, and there were 10 other, well, 9 other resident advisors to make 10. And there were a couple, I don't know, I would say almost half were of color. And this one man said to me, because you're white and because you just spent the summer working for ITT, you are automatically suspect to me. And I said, what have I done? He goes, you don't have to do anything. Because you're white and you just worked for ITT, I'm going to assume the worst about you. And he was a black man. And I was like, I haven't done anything. And he said, I've got all the information I need.
Well, I got to tell you, I can't tell you how many people I've undone with that attitude in my political career. I live in the whitest neighborhood in Washington, D.C. I live in a house that's worth over $1 million. And people all the time, I can't tell you the number of people that stood up and said, you don't understand. You don't understand up there in the white neighborhood in your white house and what it's like. And I go, you mean the guy that was orphaned at 15 years old, that dropped out of high school, that's been working full time since I was 14, that's done everything from dig ditches to work for the president of the United States? I don't understand. Let me tell you, I understand. And then I'll tell them about my life. I say, you know, I used to do the utility shuffle when I was a child. We used to pay the phone bill 1 month, the electric bill the next month, and the gas bill the next month, because we knew it took 90 days to cut us off. I've had my car, we had cars repossessed. I've been evicted from my house. I've been, you know, had to lie about my age so I could get jobs to help support my parents and, you know, my family, my mother. You know, I remember that every week when I would come and give my paycheck to my mother when I was 14, I lied and I worked 35 hours a week. There's a law against that. But I lied about my age and said I was older. I actually drove a tow truck a year and a half before I was old enough to drive. When I was 15 years old, I had a job driving a tow truck.
And they didn't ask for your driver license?
Well, I actually got in a minor accident, and the insurance company asked for my driver's license, and I said I didn't have one. And my employer jumped up at the table and said, you told me that you had a license. And I'll never forget, I said to him, no, I never did. You asked me if I could drive a tow truck, and I said yes. And that was the truth. He said, can you drive a tow truck? Yes, I can. I can drive a stick shift, but I didn't have a driver's license. But you know, every week my mother would cry when I would give her money, and she would put the money, to always tell me that she was going to put the money aside and give it back to me. And it was horrible. And you know, it wasn't until I was a full grown man that I understood it. I always thought that she cried because she felt sorry for me, because she felt sorry that I had to work. But part of the reason she cried is because she felt bad for herself, that she had fallen so low in life that she had to take money from a child to survive.
Right.
So I know all those feelings, and I can tell you, that's why I know prejudice is a two-way street, because people look at me and they say, oh yeah, you know, there's a kid whose parents paid for him to get through college. And no, none of that was true. I every penny came from me. And, I've been on my own since I was 14 years old. And not that I didn't have help. You know, I had an older sister and older brother, and they were very, very,
supportive.
Yes. And, but I understand more than people give me credit for when they look at me, because they see me white and,
and
living privileged. In the best part of town and privileged. Yes.
Right.
And, it's one of the reasons I try to give back and always have given back. I've always had a volunteer job in my life, no matter what else I've done, worked in a soup kitchen or been a community organizer or something else, because I believe, as Kennedy said, that to whom much has been given, much is expected. And a lot has been given to me in life, and I realize it. It's the only thing that I really bothers me about this new generation is their sense of entitlement about it. You know, I wonder sometimes if they really get how fortunate they are to live in this country and to have the freedoms they have and to have the things that are given to them when they could have, been born anywhere in the world. We're so fortunate.
I think they're not stupid, but it is their reality, which we can't fault them for, since some of us created that, not me and you, but the helicopter parents, and everybody's a winner and all of that other foolishness that went with that. But I truly believe that as they get older, they will gain the wisdom. It just might be delayed, because they're going to learn somehow, some way, hopefully not the hard way. But yeah, life doesn't give you what you want, and life is not fair, and life has its own journey, whether you're making other plans or not.
Well, I often say that if I could leave my children or the world actually with one piece of advice, if the most profound thing that I've ever heard in my entire life came from Mick Jagger, of all people, that you can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you find you get what you need. This is a really important thing, as far as I'm concerned. We don't always get what we want, but we need to try. And you're right. Life has its own pathway that I think personally is guided from beyond this world, that the Lord has a lot to do with this. But I think, that's the thing. You have to try. You always have to try.
And I'm a believer in the free will part. We make the choices and then we suffer the consequences. And sometimes they're blessings and sometimes they're failures. But ultimately, it's our free will that allows us to do that. And again, the best laid plans, you can prepare all you want, and then life has its own and it can be painful, and it can be, the losses that you incurred as a young man, who would prepare one for that? How is that fair? How is that right? Your sister dying of breast cancer so young, on and on and on. But it is what it is, and those people who don't accept it are the ones, they either become jaded or they start to check out, because they're defeated. And both options, in my book, are unacceptable. What they say is, life is falling down, but living is getting up.
Yeah, and I mean, that's very true. And I got to tell you, I was very bitter. I
bet you had a chip on your shoulder.
I had a chip on my shoulder. I thought,
how could you not?
God was out to get me, and until I realized how many blessings I had. And on that note, we've run out of time here, Maria. We haven't gotten around to talk to much about some of the things I want to talk about, but that's okay, because I think, sometimes we need to have these conversations. And when it comes to blessings, let me just say that in the world of internet radio, Maria Sanchez, you're the biggest blessing I've ever received. So thank you so
Michael,
much for coming
likewise.
On every week.
It's an honor and a privilege. And I was so happy to see you in your element Friday night.
Oh,
and
yeah.
that just the enthusiasm that was in the room was palpable. And a few other folks that I met that I didn't mention that I'm looking forward to continuing a relationship and getting to know them better. And some of that you engineered, which I appreciated. So it was really my pleasure and my honor to be able to be there. And congratulations. Thanks. And statehoodnow.org. And yes, the proceeds from the event Friday night, yes, to begin providing seed money, and continued success.
Thank you. Thank you. And folks, we'll see you next week, but we're going to leave you now because of our event and our love for Dick Gregory. Here's Stevie Wonder with Happy Birthday. We'll talk to you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.